Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming today. Special applause to our new and youngest guest. How old are you?
10
You're 10. Wow, I love having a new reader in the store. So thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. We are here, If I Move the Shrubbery, which is a very sweet present from staff for Mother's Day. I love that. It's so nice. We're here to talk to Ellen Crosby about her new book, Dodge and Burn. And it is in her Sophie Medina, or is it Medina? I never remember. It
Medina.
Is Medina.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
A photojournalist, which means that she's a reporter, but she, or an investigative reporter, but with a camera more so than with print. And as always is true with this series, and in fact with all of Ellen's books, the various landscapes and monuments and cultures of Washington, D.C., as opposed to Virginia wine country, in her other series, are a big part of the book. And it's one reason I read them, because I was a librarian at the Library of Congress way back and lived in Washington. And Ellen has shown me things that I never saw the entire time I was there.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I'm in my next life, I'm coming back as a tour guide.
Well, you could do that. And you're actually doing it in your books.
I know.
Right.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about Sophie. In fact, this is a book where you reveal probably more about Sophie and her family life than we ever knew.
Right.
I'm backing up because I'm looking at you at a weird angle.
I can come forward. Are we good now?
All right.
Okay.
Yep, better.
All right. So Sophie Medina is half Spanish and half American. Her father was a world-renowned soccer player who played for Real Madrid, but he was killed many years ago in a car accident. In a motorcycle accident. The reason I made Sophie half Spanish, I started writing the series a number of years ago. I spent my junior year in Spain, and I loved it. And I love the culture, I love the people, I loved everything about it. And I just thought it'd be fun to have a character who was half Spanish. Lucy Montgomery is half French because my husband was French. So I just like that, you know, little bit of to bring the foreign part of a character, of a culture into my character. So in this book, she discovers that she has a half brother she didn't know about. I don't know how far you want me to get into.
Well, I mean, I don't think these are spoilers because
okay.
We find out. Why don't you tell us about her mother? Because her parents, had a unusual and very brief marriage.
Yes. So when I wrote the book years ago, Sophie's mother was me and she was my age. And now that it's 10 years later, I've had to advance the story and just change everybody's age a little bit. But when I lived there, it was a long time ago. It was actually when Francisco Franco was still in power. It was that long ago.
It really was a long time.
It was a very long. I mean, it was before Juan Carlos and before the current king, and it was the very end of the Franco era, and it was very repressed, and it was a very different kind of country. But there was so much of the old Spain about it, the old world, you know, old world Spain, and so, but very strictly Catholic. And so, what I had happen was Sophie's mother had an affair with this incredibly good-looking Spaniard who became this world famous soccer player, and she got pregnant. And being Spain, being a Catholic country, they had to get married, and it was a disaster. And so eventually I think within 2 years, her mother just moved back to the United States, moved to Connecticut, which is where I am from, and moved in with her grandparents. And Sophie's grandfather was a very famous photographer, which is kind of how she developed her interest in photography, and she became a photojournalist.
This is also why she can have a half-brother.
Right.
On the father's side, not
right.
The mother's side, right.
Right?
Is she her mother's only child?
No, her mother remarried a very well-to-do man who owns a horse farm in Middleburg, Virginia, which is now near where I live. And she and her stepfather get along really well. She loves him. But she looks very Hispanic, and her mother was this, you know, blue-eyed blonde, and her father is quintessentially a sort of good-looking American Ralph Lauren type. So her half-brother and sister, through her mother's other marriage, look like they belong really in a Ralph Lauren commercial, and she looks like she's the maid's, you know, kid or something like that. So she sort of has this issue with her heritage and her history and sort of who she is, and she feels very strongly that her mother always saw her as a mistake. So,
Sophie in Washington D.C., which is a very cosmopolitan city with people from all over. Should be a lot more comfortable. Now, she has become a widow, and her husband, tell us about her husband, because that was a ringer you threw in there.
I know. She had married a man who was in the CIA, and in the first book, he was in Russia. He had a background as a geologist, and he was working with a British company. They were looking for oil in sort of a part of Russia where nobody thought they would discover oil, and in fact they did. But he was also there as a CIA agent and looking at the political situation. And so he ended up sort of in between the second and third book, of which there was like quite a long hiatus, about 8 years. He was assassinated in Austria. He went back to do another favor for the CIA, and it had to do with the Russians. And he was, the story is that he was killed. He was hit by a car coming out of a bar at night in Vienna. And that's the official story, and that's the way it stays. So she can't tell anybody what happened to him. And so she's now a widow, and she's trying to make her way, you know, sort of as a young widow in Washington, and has her own business. He left her well enough off that she can pretty much do whatever she wants. So she's doing pro bono work. She's just she's gotten involved with photographing the homeless. Bye. with photographing the homeless, and she can pretty much do whatever she wants.
So in this book, what is whatever she wants? It isn't exactly what she wants.
No, she the man who lives below her in the duplex that she lives in has a friend who turns out to be this incredibly wealthy philanthropist named Robson Blake, and her friend says, come to dinner, Robson Blake wants to meet you. And he asks her to take some photographs of a very rare patent that he found that supposedly was belonged to Thomas Jefferson, who actually never filed a patent in his life. But he has this patent, and he wants her to take pictures of it, and then destroy all of her files and give him everything. And so she agrees to go do that. And then he says that he's going to be he needs an author photo for a book, and the co-author said, your picture's really old. You need a new picture. So he says, will you come take my author photo? So she's going to go back to the house a second time and take a photo. So.
Right. And so she does. And then we go from there. Well, it's not a spoiler to say he's dead. There has to be a murder in here somewhere.
So she walks in, and she can't figure out why, when he's got all this incredible, old master art on the walls, and all this wonderful, these incredibly expensive paintings. The only thing that she sees is missing, and she had actually seen he has like a subterranean hall of where he keeps a lot of his art that isn't on display, and she had accidentally seen a room that was full of these beautiful icons when she was there before, and one of them she just couldn't take her eyes off, and it was in a frame, and when she finds him in his office when she goes back, the frame is there and the icon's gone, and she can't figure out why, of all the things in the house, only this icon would be gone. And it's an icon that was taken from a Ukrainian church, so which she finds out later on.
And so the question is, excuse me, the police, are they, you know, why does she get involved? Because this is really a police case.
Because her tripod was the murder weapon.
Whenever you, excuse me, I'm going to get some water. Whenever you have an amateur sleuth, you do have to have some law enforcement person connected with it. And you also need a reason for the amateur sleuth to get involved in investigating the crime. I'm going to get some water. I'll be right back.
Okay. So one of the things that that she also discovers is that she has this half-brother. And what happens is there's another part of the plot where her friend who runs the newspaper for the homeless individuals in Washington asks her if she'll photograph a soccer exhibition that they're going to have, and it's going to be for homeless kids, but Real Madrid is coming to Washington to play DC United, and he says, you know, I want somebody to take pictures of this event we're going to have with the kids. And we're going to put it in our newspaper. And he said, I want you to do it. And he doesn't know that her father played for Real Madrid. So that leads a Spanish journalist who knew her father to put their names together. And he reaches out to her and says, I knew your father. And he said, and I know your brother. And she said, she says, what brother? So that's how she finds out she has a brother who, as it turns, is his mother was British. It turns out he has an interest in art. He may or may not be an art thief, and he's very interested in the collection of Robson Blake. So that's how she really gets drawn into this. And so she meets her brother, and
I think that probably is. Yeah, all of Ellen's books are complicated. All
I don't want to tell too much. Yeah. So.
Well, that's the problem. But so when all this is going on, Sophie moves around Washington, D.C., which is when we get to see things. And she also drives on into Virginia. So we get to see part of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I was interested in, how I got her brother involved. There are two stories that go with that. One is I was doing a book event in at a vineyard in Virginia with the winemaker who's been helping me, and we were talking, and then someone said, "Oh, there's someone you should meet." And I always love it when someone wants to give you their card or says, "If you ever don't want to know about this, come talk to me." And so I've met the most interesting people that way. But she said, "I work with this young woman who's an accountant," and she said she decided, I think it was on her own, that in Loudoun County, which is the county where this vineyard is, she said she's been working with the Loudoun County police, and she said every officer has the case they couldn't solve, and it haunts that person. And she said often they don't want to talk about it because they failed. They didn't solve this case. And she said so she started taking information from the different police officers and putting them in this algorithm, and started to see similarities that they weren't aware of because they weren't talking to each other, because they weren't talking about their case. And she managed to sort of help them solve some unsolved cases by collecting all this data. So I thought that's really interesting. And then I read, have you read the book by Amaryllis Fox? She's now Amaryllis Fox Kennedy. She married Robert Kennedy III, and she's running her father-in-law's presidential campaign.
Sorry to hear that.
We're not going to go there. But before that, she wrote a book called, it's called something like My Life in the CIA, A Coming of Age in the CIA. And it was undercover. I forget the title of it. But anyway, but she ended up becoming very interested in how could you figure out where, she ended up in the Middle East, could you figure out where there might be the next sort of uprising of, you know, in Afghanistan, like where these people were hiding out. And so what would spawn some kind of something in a town, and there'd be some kind of an incident or something like that. So she started doing the same thing. She started collecting, it was all data. She just collected data. What did they have in common? So she found out there was a market. They sold falafel. They did this. And she just kept collecting all this data so that you could sort of predict what place would be likely for there to be some kind of an uprising. And the CIA apparently found out about it, according to her in her book, and they came to her and they said, you know, this is really interesting. So that's how she ended up being recruited by the CIA. So I thought between her, what she did and what this woman did for the police department, why couldn't you do the same thing for stolen art? What if you just collected a lot of data? You know, you found out like what had been stolen, where it had been stolen from. You could, and things that had been found, you found out where it was likely that it might have gone, and then you just kept collecting data. And sooner or later, you wouldn't know that it was at such and such a pawn shop or somebody's home or whatever, but you'd have an idea sort of where it would be. And then if you had a network of people who could find out, you might be able to find this art. So I invented. I invented an organization that's based on a true organization in London, where they're a database for stolen art, and they just want people to tell them, you know, you're not gonna, something that's really important, like what was stolen in my book was a small icon in a Ukrainian church, which is very important to those people, but no one's gonna, you know, the police and the, you know, Interpol, and they're not gonna go, you know, they're not gonna go looking for it. So what if some of the stuff that falls off the radar, what if there were people who went to look for it? And I loved the TV show Leverage. Did anybody else love that?
Yes, I did. I really enjoyed it.
So I, you know, it's like, well, so if you steal something stolen, is it bad or good? And if you steal something stolen, are they going to report it? No. So her brother shows up with this algorithm. And the question is, where's the icon? And then she's getting framed for this. And then she wonders, would her brother let her hang for it if it were to keep this organization going? Like, what's the greater good?
It's a really scary thought, you know, the personal versus the greater good.
And especially since they didn't know each other and they had sort of an adversarial, like they're both angry at each other for not finding the other one. You know, she's not sure how much loyalty he feels toward her. And she doesn't even know about him. And she's angry because he apparently did know about her and he didn't find her. And she had a husband in the CIA and, you know, she didn't even know what he did. And she's finding out things that he did that she didn't know about. So, you know, the CIA is in my backyard in Washington. And my kids went to school with people whose parents worked there. And for some of the other alphabet agencies, I have a son in intelligence. I go to church with people who, work at the agency and neighbors. And you just don't know. So where do you go with that? And I just found that really intriguing, that whole sort of moral gray issue. And I ended up, so Sophie has a friend who is a Jesuit priest, and they went to high school together, and she dated him at one point. It was pretty serious, and then he decided he wanted to go off and be a priest. So he goes to her, she goes to him to ask him, what to do. So I went to a priest at my church, and I said, give me your take on this. And he said he didn't have the answers either. You know, I thought I need what is there like a no, this is really wrong. You know, you shouldn't be doing this. But if you steal something stolen, and then she has a police friend who says, you can't take the law, her lawyer actually. You can't take the law into your own hands. I mean, this way is anarchy. I mean, that's where we're a society of laws. You can't do that. So what do you do?
Very interesting question, right? And I suppose when you're looking at anybody's superb collection, you have to wonder how much of it is even true in museums. Well, we know that because a lot of museums are returning pieces that they have suspect provenance. There have been two or three galleries in New York that have really been...
Well, the Met has...
Well, the Met has, I'm just saying that the Met itself, but, the people they bought things from or however turn out to be highly suspect. But I think that's going to be true in virtually any museum.
So while I was writing this, I found this website called artnet.com, and they have a newsletter. So I clicked yes to get it, and so every day something would come in and it'd be about exhibits and all these artnet.com. There's inevitably something called crime. And every single, and it's in, don't read the acknowledgement until after you read the book, but every single event that I ended up sort of referencing in there happened while I was writing the book that year. I mean, it is the fourth most stolen or plundered item after arms, money, drugs, and then art. And one of the stories that I wrote about was there was an article about Madonna of something that she was doing, music or whatever, but in the background there was a painting, and the painting, someone who saw the article was the mayor of this little tiny village in France. The painting had been in their village and it had vanished
during the war.
Yeah. And so they wrote Madonna and said, oh, well, we know you bought it at an auction, but could we borrow our painting back, please? And I don't know where that went. She didn't answer. And she said, well, no, this is a copy. I understand. The other one was destroyed. I was told this is a copy. So, I mean, you can't, you know, and...
Yeah, but I mean, the wholesale Nazi plundering of art around the world has created, it's never all going to be found, and it's never all going to be attributed properly to the people that owned it.
But even that, I mean, when I lived in Russia, and that was the other thing, was that, I lived in Russia, and my husband
went to Russia,
and you know what, they couldn't take care of it. I mean, it was like, the stories were that it would be like under, in the basement of the Hermitage in a box.
Listen, I spent a week at the Hermitage some years ago in December as a friend at the Hermitage,
and
my
froze.
Husband and I, and by then they had put the impressionists that they'd looted.
Oh, had they?
If you saw the movie The Monument Man,
yes.
You know that the whole point of the movie was for the art people on the Allied side to try to get to some of the stash that the Nazis had created before the Russians got there, because the Russians would take it back to Russia. But they, for ages, everybody wondered what the Impressionist was that they had taken. So they've now actually exhibited that. But earlier, the Russians also took the Trojan Horde from Germany, from Berlin, where it was in the old museum, right, and took it back to, right, Russia. So, right, that was Heinrich Schliemann, you know, when, right, he discovered Troy.
Right.
Maybe,
right,
discovered Troy. It's not entirely clear,
right,
that it was Troy. But, you know, somewhere near Troy, anyway.
Well, the other thing I got interested in is your good friend, John Cole,
right,
who is now the historian of the Library of Congress, and you two work together, right?
We were both interns at,
yeah,
the library,
yeah,
together. And
so
his wife, Nancy, who was the librarian at the Smithsonian,
right,
was,
right,
another one.
So, John had this this group that he brought together every year called the Reading Promotion Partners, and I ended up being a member of it as a representative for Mystery Writers of America. This is, again, like 15 years ago, maybe. And one of the things that the Reading Promotion Partners did is they brought together anybody who was interested in writing, literacy, libraries, and I forget what all else, but anything to do, any organization that had something to do with that. And so in the beginning, everybody would go around the table and you'd tell what your organization did. And gradually there got to be these collaborations between, like there was an organization that they tried to get books into prisons. And then there was somebody else who said, well, you know what, we have books, we could help you with that. So that hence the partners. But one of the things that I learned that I became very interested in was, and this was about books, was that that a lot of libraries in war-torn countries were being destroyed, and some really old historical libraries that you could never replace. And that just stayed with me. And then when I started reading about what's happening in Ukraine, and I'm sure in, you know, other places around there, Afghanistan for sure, is they're destroying the art.
Well, or Syria, where,
yeah,
you know, one of my great regrets is, and we were in Jordan in, I'm trying to remember when it was, must have been 2010 maybe. Anyway, we could have gone to Syria. We could have gone to Palmyra.
Oh.
And we thought, as people do when they're traveling, oh, we'll go next time. And of course, by the time we got to next time, it had all been destroyed, you know. By,
and there's nothing you can, it's gone.
There is nothing you can do about it. But going back to the week at the Hermitage, what we learned is not the stuff that's hidden in the basement, but the stuff that's actually on display is right by open windows with, you know, the dirt, and I mean, there's a Leonardo right by an open window where the, you know, sun hits it and the dirt blows in and the whole bit. And so that's a big argument about, you know, whether people can take care.
And that's, should you return it or not? And that's another issue is,
well, that's the whole thing with,
yeah,
the Elgin marbles that goes on,
yeah,
forever. Although the Elgin marbles were actually purchased from the legitimate government, they were not stolen. There was money raised in Lord Elgin. It's not Elgin, it's Elgin.
Oh.
Lord Elgin actually bought from the Turkish government, which at that point was in control of Greece. He actually bought them and shipped them back. So all this bit about, you know, their only argument is it's heritage.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no argument,
yeah,
at least not a legitimate argument, that they were stolen.
Well, the other thing that bothered me a lot as well is this whole notion of destroying the museums and everything else as a way of sort of a psychological warfare. And again, one of the stories that I read was really sad in this ArtNet newsletter was that a group of people from France had taken a train into Ukraine, snuck in under all kinds of cover, and took a lot of artifacts from one of the museums. And the train, they got the train back out again, and they were keeping it at the Louvre. And so the minister of culture from Ukraine came for that, and it was just a terribly sad event because he said, you know, I'm glad you can enjoy it, but my country's being destroyed, and so here it is. And it, you know, it just breaks your heart that they had to sneak in and then sneak out, and how they did it. And it was like something out of the Monuments Men.
There's a really sinister thought that I have had over the years. What if instead of flying one of those planes into the Twin Towers, they dropped it on the Met on Fifth Avenue?
Oh, don't even. Oh, gosh.
But I mean, seriously, think about that. You know, everything like that is vulnerable. You know, every museum is vulnerable to all kinds of things.
I think that's why the whole world was aghast when Notre Dame burned. I mean,
yeah,
it belongs to all of us, you know? I mean, it's just you just,
it's amazing that they have managed to sort of put it back together when it didn't
we
look
had
as
fundraisers,
though.
You know.
Yeah, no, we did too. I contributed to it, but I mean, there were so many problems connected. You know, the water soaking into the limestone, and you know, it's astonishing to me that the engineers have been able to. I mean, it would really be a tragedy if it all came down of its own weight when people were inside it. You know, which looked like they might never be able to stabilize it again.
Yeah, yeah. So all of those things really fascinated me, and I sure. think there are, I said, you know, sort of moral gray areas, and I like those kinds of, you know, those.
I wish that the data collection thing would help us find the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum paintings, which, you know, that comes up a lot. But you know, I'm worried that they're really destroyed. That we're never, and one of them's a Vermeer.
Yeah.
Of which there are so
very
few.
That the painting in my first book, Moscow Nights, was a Vermeer, just because there were so few of them. The missing painting was a Vermeer. Yeah, because there's hardly any of them. I know.
I mean, art is vulnerable. It just is, you know. We, at least today, we have lots of digital images of most of it, whereas in the past, you know, there was art that nobody really had images of. So when it was really gone, it was gone.
Yeah. But it's such a controversial and such a lightning rod subject. I mean, there's, I think it just, you know, where you stand depends on where you sit or whatever, you know, whether you think, you know, should we give things back when you know full well it's going to be stolen again or it's going to end up on the black market again? I mean, do you keep it?
Or it won't be kept in any condition that will allow it to survive.
When we were living in Moscow, the Kremlin Armory, they got all the Fabergé eggs. From as many, the queen had a whole bunch. I mean, there were they brought them all to the armory, and it was the biggest collection I think they'd ever had. And then after that, they were going to San Diego, and so my husband and I ended up writing about the stories for our respective organizations, and so we were talking to the woman who was in charge of the whole thing, and they, because she said, San Diego, but she. They didn't have any way to protect these eggs. And what are they going to, I mean, they were on loan. So they told the museum in San Diego, if you want to do this, you have to provide all the glass cases and you have to do all the posters and you have to do all the brochures. And so that was the condition. So they built all the, because there was no way they could protect them in the Soviet Union in those days. But it was an exquisite collection. But, you know, when they're that poor, what do you do? And they don't know how to care for stuff.
I mean, museum security over the years has been, you know, we can go back to the, whatever it was stolen at the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
You know, it was a disgruntled guard. Or remember the one in Tucson? We had remember the painting? I can't think of the name of the guy. It's modern. It was stolen from a museum in Tucson and eventually found hanging in the bedroom of a couple in New Mexico when they died and the realtor came in. It was hanging behind a door. I can't remember the name the artist. But anyway, it's eventually, now it's gone back to Tucson finally.
I did a lot of reading about things that are stolen. And surprisingly, a lot of it is someone walks in and takes it and walks out. I mean, it's not this whole big, you know, where you see, you know, the like on Leverage where she flips over all the wires and she does somersaults in and she comes down from the ceiling and she does all this. It's like
I top copied that old movie with Peter Ustinov, which I absolutely love. No, I mean, you know, art heists, a lot of them are very elaborate and carried out, but a huge amount of it, as you say. And not
The guard takes the guard goes to the bathroom. Yeah.
Well, I think they've improved museum security. They have all kinds of alarms now and other stuff. And I know that we showed up at the, I think it was in Philadelphia, not Pittsburgh, but anyway, whichever museum it was in Pennsylvania, and they were getting ready to hang I think it might have been Rubens, but anyway, to hang some exhibition. And we were there to meet the chairman of the art department, who was a friend. And they wouldn't let us anywhere near. The whole thing was all blocked off. And the insurance required that only bonded museum people could be there at the unpacking and all, you know. So I think that they have improved their security in a lot of places.
Right.
But there are a lot of small museums or, you know.
Right.
I don't know. I haven't been to the Ashmolean for years, but I'm going to London at the end of the month. If I run up to Oxford, will I find the Ashmolean has, you know, because it is a legitimate cabinet of curiosity. that really? Started out as a real cabinet and then developed into a museum finally. And now it's a museum in the city of Oxford.
Wow.
But when I was there, 1985, as a graduate student, there was no security.
Wow. You all know, don't you, that Barbara's father-in-law made the second largest donation to the Library of Congress after Thomas Jefferson, and also donated art to the National Gallery of Art. Did you all know that?
I love it that I have my own librarian at the Library of Congress now.
Oh, I have met.
I do. I the Rosenwald met. Librarian. You yes. know, used to be Dan DeSimone, but the Folger poached him.
Oh, did
so
they?
So it's now a woman who, okay. you know, I have not
you
yet
gotta
met.
You got to come back and do one of those tours.
I do think it's really funny that, you know.
Because you were going to come to Washington, and it was right before COVID, and there was going to be something with Lessing's art at the National Gallery, and I forget what it was. And then COVID came and you didn't come. What was that? Do you remember?
It was primarily his Blake collection at the okay. National Gallery.
Okay.
When you go in there, he's on the right, and Thomas Mellon, or the other way around, is on the left as the founders of that.
Yeah.
My husband's great-grandfather is Susan Roebuck, but he was a genuine philanthropist. He didn't want his name attached to things. And then his son, Rob's grandfather, as a result of having all that money, was able to become a phenomenal collector. And his thing was drawings in art,
and
books.
Incunabula,
which are books printed between Gutenberg in 1465 or 85 and 1500. There's a gap at the end of the 15th century, and those books are called incunabula. Once you get to 1500, then we're off into regular printed books.
And are they the ones with the first letter is really elaborate?
It could be all kinds of things. It just depends on, you know, the artwork and
the time. They're beautiful.
They are beautiful. So do you all know why first printings are theoretically the only valuable part of a book? Well, when Mr. Gutenberg decided to take metal type and put it in a frame to make it work, he would cast the individual letters, and then you would have in eighth grade, I actually worked in the print shop at my school back when I was a kid. You would have a metal tray, and you had to do it upside down. You would assemble all the letters, which are in boxes, until you made a sentence, and you would put leading between them, and eventually you would lock it all into a frame. So it was all metal locked into a frame. But guess what the first printing press was? Do any of you know? It was a wine press. So they put the metal frame down, and then they inked it, and then they put a piece of paper on it, and then they crashed the wine press down. So guess what happened? The type degraded from the very first time from the pressure of the wine press. So the first printing was always the clearest one, and each time after that, the type would break down or something. So today, it's all electronic, so it doesn't really. But people confuse first editions and first printings all the time. A first edition is the first edition unless the author completely revises the book or adds new material or something. So almost everything is the first edition because not that many books get amended. But the first printing of the first edition is still the valuable one. And what that really means is that you are smart enough to buy it ahead of time from a store like ours, told you to do that, or you paid a lot of money to somebody who was smart enough to do that and collected it. But that's the reason. And the way you can tell is if you open your book and look at the back of the title page. The title page is the one that has Ellen's name and the title. That's it right there. And turn it over. And on the back, there will be something, either a run of numbers or there will be letters or they will just say something that says, you know, first printing. If it's an American book, they almost, the Severn House books are actually British. They always have a run of numbers, like 1 through 10 on the back. I haven't seen that one, so that's why.
I don't know if they do.
I don't.
No, they
let me see the British one, and
no,
I can
they,
tell
I think
you.
They
Thank
don't.
You very much. It does say, you're right, it just says First World Edition.
Yeah,
it doesn't actually
do
have, no, but if you were to look at an American book, you would see there's a run of numbers on that title page somewhere. And every time they reprint it, they drop a number. So the first printing will be like 1 through 10, and then when the second printing, it'll be 2 through 10. And if you look at some books, like the Da Vinci Code or something, it might say 99, or you might be at the 202nd printing or something. But that's how you tell. Occasionally, there's been a publisher, and the run was numbers, I mean letters. So it would be A, B, C, D, whatever, and then they would drop the A. So and apparently they don't do that.
No, I don't know why. I
don't know that they reprint stuff very often, although I know they do, because Jeffrey Seiger's new book got a second printing. Yeah. But anyway, if you're going to buy a book, you know, you might as well look and see what you're getting, if you can, right? So my job most of the time is to try to buy, especially a new author, to try to figure out if it's a book we ought to grab while the printing is, because they are now printing in such small numbers. For a long time, it all kind of went away, that collector market. But now that they are using data, they print to their pre-orders. And so that's why we're always after you to order your book early, because if I know how many books we can sell, I can turn that number in really early, and then we can get first printings. I know, it's constant pressure to do it. And I think it's great that they are now doing that, because for a while they were doing like, 200,000 John Grishams at a throw, and there was no value in it whatsoever. But now it's not working that way. So publishing goes up and down like everything else with technology. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, we've digressed. So we always digress.
We do.
But anyway, I do think that Ellen's book is really interesting. The art, the moral questions, and the tours around D.C., plus you get to learn a lot more about Sophie. And this is the third book we can get. The first, their Moscow Rules is not...
Wait a minute. Sophie book is multiple exposure.
Right.
Ghost Image. Blow Up, and this one.
I'm not sure that we could get the first one. I got whatever we could get.
Oh, okay.
I'm not... Anyway, they're up in the front, and they're nice to read in order. The paperbacks are great. So any of you have questions that you would like to ask? Never mind about the book trade, but anything else?
I have a comment, not a question.
Sure.
But I just want to thank you and all your staff for doing these kind of things. I've got your email, and I've never read your books, but I read the synopsis, and I thought that sounds fascinating. And then I looked you up online, and I was like, Virginia, I'm the Wine Country. You've done this series, too, so now I have another author.
Well, the Wine Country Mysteries are up in front. I love them. I've read all of Ellen's books, actually, every single one.
Do you want to know how we met? Barbara is amazing. We lived overseas for a long time. We came back from Russia. England. We came back from England, and I didn't know anything about publishing in the United States. I had one book that came out in London when we lived there, Moscow Nights, and it was based on the time that we spent there when my husband was a foreign correspondent and I was working, and then I got a job as a sort of a freelancer for ABC News. So anyway, so I walked into the book room at BoucherCon, which is the big mystery conference. Every year it moves, and that in 2001, right after 9/11, it was in Washington, D.C., and I walked into the book room, and there was this very attractive woman, and I went over, and I introduced myself, and I said, my name's Ellen Crosby, and she said, and I'm Barbara Peters, and you wrote Moscow Nights, and I loved it, and I gave you a great review, and I thought, no one knows I wrote that book. No one. It only came out in England, but you knew, and we stayed, it was just like, I've been here for every book. Except Moscow Nights.
Now it's been wonderful.
I could not have been more floored and amazed. And Barbara, I mean, there's nobody you don't know. There's no interview you haven't done there. I mean, I heard about the one you just did at in Left Coast with
Bob Degoni.
Yeah, everybody was
raving
about it.
And his publisher. No, I dragged his publisher into it. And the reason I did is he's published by Amazon Publishing, and most bookstores boycott Amazon Publishing. But you have to distinguish between Amazon in Amazon Publishing, they are actually different things, although there's a big umbrella there. And they have some wonderful writers. But I wanted people to see Gracie, the publisher, and me together an event for one of her authors.
And that's what I say. Barbara, I mean, I think you've been, you and Rob have been like guests of honor and won just all kinds of awards and accolades. So it's, you know, I couldn't imagine not coming here for a book, and I'm so grateful to be invited back.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. Okay, so. You do you remember that BoucherCon? That was
the next November one's going to be in a couple of years.
After, in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. It was a big VoucherCon. Lots of people had registered for it. And 9/11 scared everybody.
Yeah, it was.
And so the foreign authors still came, but a lot of the American authors were too scared too. And so I got a call the day before we were leaving from the organizers, and they said, "You're still coming, right?" I said, "Yep." And they said, "How many panels do you think you could moderate?"
Really?
So I did 17.
Oh, my gosh.
Literally ran, practically, because fortunately I'd read them all.
She reads everything.
So it wasn't even hard.
Wow.
And then they had one in Austin, Texas, where the organizer didn't want to have moderators, decided there would be no moderators. Remember that?
I didn't go, but I heard about it.
I was walking down the hall, and people would leap out of rooms. Don Winslow, I still remember, leapt out of a room and literally grabbed me. And they just needed somebody to start it, to introduce the authors. And I remember there was this obscure British author who wrote a series set in, it was like in the Midlands somewhere with some, so they were taking bets that I couldn't do it. Fortunately, I was up for the task, right? It was so funny. I do think that, reading, unfortunately, most people who run bookstores don't have time to read. But I discovered years and years ago that the secret to having a good bookstore was that somebody reads. And everybody else does all the work. So I'm the one who reads.
Do you know one of the things that I like about Severn House is they will send you an autoresponder on the day that says, "I'm not answering emails, I'm editing today."
Right.
And I think that's great because everybody else, like New York, they're all in meetings. And we talked about this when I met my editor in San Diego at VoucherCon this year. And she said, "Well, we believe you should have a life outside of your work and that you don't do the reading at night and on the weekends. And we limit our meetings to sort of like what's germane, what's important, why you need to be there. We get in, we do what we say what we're going to say, we say it, and then we're done." And she said, "And then people have reading days. And you sit at work all day and edit and read, that's work." And I they're the only publisher I know who does that.
I think it's great.
I do too.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your kind comment.
Yes.
Does anybody else have no? All right. Well, then Ellen will be happy to sign a book for you. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you, virtual audience, for joining us.
Thank you. Sorry
about all the digressions. It just sort of every once in a while happens.
We always do this.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.